Coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast today, we discuss how expecting moms can help protect themselves and their babies from severe respiratory illness. We discuss the book, The Motivation Mindset Workbook. We talk to the author of The Last of the Autumn Rain. Experts are warning that Gen Z and young shoppers are the group most likely to fall for online scams. We talk about ways to protect yourself. And we talk to the author of Troublemaker, The Fierce, Unruly Life of Jessica Mitford.
Dr. Brenna Hughes joining in, Chair of Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine's Committee on Infectious Diseases and Emerging Threats. Big title for an important concept and discussion to have. What's the latest when it comes to pregnancy and vaccines? We do turn to you, Dr. Hughes. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Let's get right into our conversation with you to discuss the latest information about maternal vaccines, vaccine guidance, and more. Why are maternal vaccines, well, an important part of prenatal care?
Yes, thanks for the question, and thanks for having an interest in this topic. There are a number of vaccines that are important during pregnancy, particularly in respiratory virus season. They are able to decrease both maternal illness as well as neonatal risk. There are four vaccines that we generally recommend in pregnancy. Two are really focused on decreasing the risk of maternal severe disease, but have the benefit of also helping to decrease the risk of neonatal illness. And the other two are really primarily focused on preventing neonatal illness. They can decrease the risk of moms having to be in the hospital or even the ICU, and decrease the risk of infants from having to be hospitalized from respiratory illnesses.
Which vaccines are actually recommended during pregnancy and why?
Yeah, great question. There are two that are primarily focused on maternal health. The first is the COVID-19 vaccine, which decreases the risk of maternal severe illness from COVID infection. And then the other is influenza. That also decreases the risk of maternal illness. It has been shown to decrease the risk of hospitalization and ICU admission for pregnant patients. Pregnant patients are at higher risk of developing severe illness than when they're not pregnant. And so it's extremely important for people to get their vaccines during pregnancy, even if they haven't gotten them in the past, to decrease that risk of maternal illness. Those vaccines also decrease the risk of neonates getting severe illness from flu and COVID infection as well. But we know that having a sick mom increases the risk of having a sick baby as well. So it actually provides benefit to both the mom and the infant. The other two are really focused on decreasing the risk of neonatal illness. So the Tdap or whooping cough vaccine is given to mom to decrease the risk of the infant getting whooping cough during the first few months of life before the infant is old enough to be vaccinated themselves. And that is also the case for the RSV vaccine. The RSV vaccine can be given during pregnancy and the later part of pregnancy to decrease the risk of the infant getting RSV during the RSV season after birth. And it allows the infant, both of those allow the infant to be protected right from the time of birth, because those antibodies that are developed from the vaccine travel through the placenta and are available to the infant really immediately at birth.
What do you want expecting mothers to know about COVID-19 vaccines during pregnancy?
Yeah, that's a really important question as well. I had the unfortunate experience of being a high-risk obstetrician during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, and I saw many patients during those couple of years in the ICU and on ventilators during pregnancy. It is a tragedy when you see a a pregnant patient that has to be on a ventilator. Really every individual patient that I saw in the ICU during that time frame was unvaccinated. The COVID-19 vaccine have been clearly shown to decrease the risk of hospitalization and ICU admission and requiring mechanical ventilation during pregnancy. And so it is very clearly recommended by multiple medical societies that focus on pregnancy recommendations in order to decrease the risk of severe illness in moms.
Lastly, before I ask for references, resources, are maternal vaccines covered by insurance?
Yeah, great question. The vast majority of maternal vaccines are covered by insurance. Every state and insurance product differs, and so certainly people should check their insurance coverage. But in general, the vast majority of insurance companies do cover all four of the maternal vaccinations that I mentioned earlier today.
Thank you. Do your research and homework. What do you leave us with, Dr. Hughes?
I would leave you with really the importance of maternal vaccination as a public health tool to improve the health of our community. We know that vaccines are among the greatest public health interventions that are available to us in the United States. They've been studied, they're safe. They're safe both for mom and for infants, and they can actually decrease the risk of so many complications and how fortunate we are to be able to have them available to us and to our patients. And so I would just encourage patients to talk with their physicians if they have any concerns about getting vaccines, so that they can understand the scientific benefits and health benefits of having these vaccines available to them.
Great. What's the best resource for us?
There are a number of great resources. The Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine is the committee that I chair has a number of available resources for folks, as well as the American College of OBGYN, as well as CV and highriskpregnancyinfo.org.
Dr. Brenna Hughes, you do chair the Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine's Committee on Infectious Diseases and Emerging Threats. Continue good work you do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Get out your pen and pencil, or head to your smartphone or your local bookstore. The Motivation Mindset Workshop. 3, 2, 1. The Motivation Mindset Workbook, all about our conversation, helping teens and tweens discover what they love to do. Good that you are here, co-author Dr. Ellen Broughton on the line with Dr. Hillary Bush by your side. Hey, there's nothing like a workbook for teens and tweens. It's all about getting things done. Good morning to you, Ellen.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Appreciate you. Let's take this apart. The Motivation Mindset Workbook. It's good to be motivated. What are you all about?
So motivation is really a tough topic for us these days. It's something I hear from parents I've heard from parents for a long time about how their kids just aren't motivated to do something. And motivation is really why we do the things that we do. And it's not a single character trait. It's kind of complicated. And I think kids these days they're distracted by screens and lots of things that are going on in their lives, overscheduled. And so finding a way to get kids motivated is why I wrote this book along with Dr. Bush, and also wrote another book called Bright Kids Who Couldn't Care Less. And so this workbook is really filled with activities that parents and teachers can use to sort of think how to get kids more motivated.
Thank you. You, of course, well-credentialed, widely recognized as the foremost expert in the field of pediatric neuropsychological and psychological assessment, of course, particularly in the areas of assessing learning disabilities and attention disorders. All right, again, power of repetition, the motivation mindset workbook. Where does one start here?
Well, a few of the things that we came to really think are important for motivation are looking at our aptitudes, which are things that we really do well. Look at the things that give us pleasure, which is something we really don't take stock of in our world right now, both as adults and kids. Mm-hmm. And then what are the things we like to practice? What are the things we like to do and spend time doing? So we call this the aptitude, practice, and pleasure. And we try and give activities and ideas to help parents really operationalize those things. So how can I get more of what makes me happy? Who am I? And what actually does make me happy? Those are the sorts of things that we really talk about in the book.
And again, you devote a whole page to how to use this workbook. I'm just going to kind of open a page and let's discuss what makes me happy. Best day ever with a twist. You want us to look back at the fun ideas you came up with in Best Day Ever. Expand from here.
Oh, this is a great activity, because what we're really asking people to do is think about what made them happy. So when we're unmotivated, we oftentimes can't think of anything that's going to make us happy. And one of the ways to do that is to think back, well, where was a time in my life that I really felt the best? And we can do that as adults as well as kids. And sometimes it's, you know, when I was 4 and I was doing, you know, something involved in something, or when I was 13 and I spent the summer with my grandparents doing nothing and just sort of playing in the woods. Or it could be when you learn something new, like a new instrument. So those are that's an activity that really makes us think about, all right, even if I'm not motivated now, when was I and what was that like and what made that so special for me? And that's the kind of insight that we can gain about ourselves to sort of figure out where to go from here, especially when we're stuck.
Dr. Ellen Broughton with us, the Motivation Mindset Workbook, out helping teens and tweens discover what they love to do. Ellen, your chapter 6 is close your book with a few other things that can get in the way of motivation, even including sleeping better.
Oh, sleeping is huge. So if I had one recommendation to make to parents these days, and adults too, is that we don't get enough sleep. And so a lot of our issues related to things even like anxiety and depression have their roots in not enough sleep, but particularly motivation. If we're tired, we don't really want to do a whole lot of anything. So if I had only one thing to say, I would say that. The other things that are in there in terms of things that can get in our way are things like spending too much time on screens, not getting out and moving enough. And for children, that really means getting out and playing and doing things, not necessarily in organized sports, but in other aspects of life where you're just enjoying being outside or enjoying moving, enjoying doing something. So those are the biggest things, not moving enough, too much screens, not enough sleep, are the three things that really get in our way in terms of not being motivated.
And of course, you do include, I wish my parents knew, under your Who Am I?
Yes, I think that is something. I find that I even have parents say to me, I don't want to know what gives my child pleasure. I'm afraid they're going to say video games or something that I don't want. And that almost never, ever happens, because kids know that video games don't necessarily give them pleasure. So really having the conversations and starting those conversations with your child about, you know, what gives you pleasure, and having the child have the opportunity to say, listen, I wish you knew this about me, but you never asked. Those are the sorts of conversation starters that can be really important in understanding your child's motivation and demotivation.
How long, or maybe the better question is, how do I know working with my child with the workbook is working?
Well, that's a great question. I think what you want to see are behaviors that are different and insight that they're having in terms of their own ability to reflect on where they are and what they want to do. I think the main thing that you want to get out of the workbook is how to make good goals. And goals really come out of being able to look at yourself, being able to figure out a growth mindset, like what is going to, you know, a fixed mindset is sort of thinking like, this is the way things are, they're never going to change. And what we want to really accomplish with this workbook is more of a growth mindset, kind of thinking that there's always room for change, always room to grow, always room for things to get better. And the only way to really do that is to reflect, to have an idea of how that can happen, and then make goals that are not just active goals, but also things that we can reflect on and change as time goes on. So it's not like doing the workbook is going to, you know, I'm finished and now life is perfect. But to think about motivation as a lifelong process, that we're all going to be at times in our lives unmotivated. And the way to do that is to get back into thinking about, who am I? What gives me pleasure? How do I want to spend my time? And moving from there.
It's very practical. Again, target audience, teens and tweens, but adults, important for us to review as well. All right, Dr. Ellen Broughton, B-R-A-A-T-E-N. How do we find out more information?
My website is drellenbroughton.com, and you can find me right there.
All right. Keep up your good work. Thanks for looking out for our future generations and continue with your personal motivation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Last of the Autumn Rain. It's a book by Diana Louise Webb, described as an engrossing tale of an uncanny and sometimes frightening life, says Kirkus Reviews. It's a work of fiction, but it does offer a real-life scenario. So let's talk to you, Diana, about your latest good work. Good morning.
Good morning, Shelley, and thank you so much for having me on the show.
Welcome.
Yes, Last of the Autumn Rain, it's a psychological thriller, and the underlying theme is the mental health crisis in this country.
Yes.
Sometimes that needs to be addressed, and I think in the past, what people have done is they have chosen to sweep those types of things under the rug, such as not just mental health illness, but domestic violence. And I do believe now that it's coming out more and people are addressing it, and it's not so much as a shame or as an embarrassment. The book is also not only just to show that type of message, but it's a very captivating, chair-gripping read. It features Julie Cromwell, and she is the daughter of two medical professionals. And it is her journey from when she was a child as she continues on through life. And she turns out to be a mentally ill person and has different kinds of challenges that turn out to be very earth-shattering and something that everyone that reads the book could probably relate to in terms of being the different characters in the book at one time or another in a person's life. So it has some realistic scenarios that individuals and readers can relate to, and it also has just some gripping tales of fantastic reading.
Yes, you write from two perspectives, which have personally affected her, completely changed her life and more. Before I have you go into even a deeper dive, you have your bachelor's in psychology, you have your Juris Doctorate degree. You are a survivor of over 12 years of unjust years in federal prison, a tenacious victor yourself?
Yes, that's true. I met a gentleman who had indicated that he was into flipping houses. And when we met, I was working at a law firm, and he came in with some concerns about a speeding ticket that he had, and he wanted to address those. And after that, he asked if I wanted to help him invest, and I indicated that I might, you know, think about doing that. So we were looking at the different houses that he had, and then he had challenges that it was wintertime, and he couldn't put in the windows and different things. So he came over to my house. I knew him approximately 4 months, but what I didn't know, he was already involved in some kind of a drug conspiracy, and he was distributing methamphetamines. And I'm not sure how much the listeners know about the conspiracy laws in the country in the 90s, because this is when this occurred. but they don't need to have drugs to have a drug case, and the rest can come on based on hearsay of other people. So during those 4 months, he was dealing drugs, and there were times where I'd been in a car. I hadn't done anything wrong, but I had been with him, and it was actually unbeknownst to me what was going on. And the minute I found out, I tried to extricate myself from the situation. Then an indictment came down, and I was named as a co-defendant, and he was named as a co-defendant, and there were three other individuals that were also named, or two other individuals that were named as co-defendants. And since I was unable to provide information, which is what the government wants whenever someone gets arrested, they want you to provide information on other people. And they asked me to do that, and I couldn't do that. So what ended up happening is I received a sentence of 12 and a half years in federal prison, which represented more time than all three co-defendants added up, and three times that amount of the kingpin. I had many judges and Congress and a governor all petitioning to help me, and nothing transpired in that realm. Now the laws have changed a little bit so that they have some concessions for first-time nonviolent offenders. But at that time, they did not, and the conspiracy laws are very, very unfair. And during that time, I have also had a best friend, and she had ended up committing suicide. She was giving away her jewelry and doing things that a person wouldn't normally do if you didn't think you were going to exit the earth. And this sort of serves the premise of my book. And she also acted in ways where not having an appreciation for what goes on a daily basis. And because of that, I talked to her family, and everybody disregarded what had happened, and then she ended up killing herself. She overdosed on sleeping pills. So I think that was another part of why I wrote the book. And then finally, I had dated a man, and when we split up and I wasn't interested in continuing the relationship, he broke into my home and tried to murder me. He's currently in prison at this time, but I think that also has a reflection on the police department that I don't know if they always go after someone until after something happens. And a lot of times it's because they have too much to do or they're understaffed, but it was a very traumatic event. And when you undergo traumatic events of any sort, not just the person involved has the issues, but your family and friends are also affected. And I think that's important that people know that. So yes. When I wrote this novel, Last of the Autumn Rain, I incorporated some of those experiences of the emotions that take place whenever you have a traumatic event. And it's really not a difference in degree, it's a difference in kind. Because every person, I think, that walks this earth has issues. And again, those issues should be addressed. And I think that would be a commonality everybody shares, because life isn't always, a bowl of roses.
Yes. Reintroduction of you, Diana Louise Webb, Last of the Autumn Rain. Thank you for sharing your history. And I'm glad, that you are living a living testament to the cliche, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I see. So thank you for that. You are also the daughter of a German child survivor of East Prussia?
Yes, I am. My mother is 89 years old, and she fled East Prussia at age 9. They went to a lot of trauma in her life. Her little brother also died when he was an infant, and she was German. She's not Jewish. And of interest, I wrote another book, which was called The Butterfly Cometh, Putting the Color Back into Life. And that has 171 stories of how to live a great life with thought-provoking questions at the end. And one of the stories discussed my mother's father, which would be my grandfather. And he worked for Hitler. Everybody did at the time. And they didn't like him. It's just the Germans had to. And he was a tool maker. So when he was recalled as a tool maker, he had been with some coworkers, and they were talking about the food, and he had made a mention that the food was not that great. And he said what my mom referred to as a little prayer, come, dear Gubbles, be our guest and give us what you promised us. We don't want margarine and herring. We want what you eat and Mr. Goering. Mr. Goering was the second in command. So someone reported my grandfather that he was complaining, and they called in all his coworkers and questioned him about the food and the comment that he made. And when they questioned him, he said, you know, the food could be a little bit better. Well, the next day, they sent in a worker to work side by side with him, and that worker had on brand new coveralls. And my grandfather knew in 1944 nobody had new coveralls. So it was a plant from the SS. And this person continuously spoke very negatively about Hitler. And when he did that, he was just waiting for my grandfather to agree with him so they could haul him off to a concentration camp. Mm. My grandfather didn't agree with him. And in fact, he picked up a hammer and he said, if you say anything bad about my beloved leader, I'll hit you with the hammer. Now, he didn't mean it that way. He just wanted to get rid of the person because he knew. And the next day, the man was gone.
Well, Diana, we need to let you go. Last of the Autumn Rain is your read and more about you. How do we find out more information and get the book?
Wonderful. It's available at your local indie bookstores. I like to support the indie bookstores. It's also available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And you can also reach me at my website, which is dianaweb.us. And you can also reach me at my other website, which is dianaloiseweb.com.
Twill soon be autumn. Thank you for sharing your story, your life, and your good work. Last of the Autumn Rain, Diana Louise Webb. Here's a timely conversation, well, topic of conversation. Frenzy, are y'all frenzied with holiday deals, TikTok gift trends, and more? Experts are warning that Gen Z and young shoppers are the group most likely to fall for online scams. That's where we're going, so we bring you on Lindsay Brian Podvin, financial therapist and author of The Financial Anxiety Solution. Good morning, Lindsay.
Hi, from Ann Arbor, just across the state.
Goodness gracious, seven of you living in Ann Arbor on a wonderful school there as well. But why digress? Hey, Lindsay, talk to me a little bit about, you and what a financial therapist is and the good work that you present with your book.
Sure. So a financial therapist is kind of what it sounds like. My background is as a traditional therapist. I'm a trained social worker, but I specialize in how money and emotions get all tangled up. And in my work with Cash App, what I do is share how emotions can impact our relationship with money. And it's the holiday season, so we're talking about how, you know, different ads and scams can kind of pop up and press on people's emotions and kind of lean them toward doing decisions that they might not normally make if they were feeling a bit more grounded.
Yes, from wish lists to wallets, let's talk about helping kids build smarter money habits for the holidays and beyond. And, of course, getting right into the topic of, first of all, the scams. You want us to what? Spot the fakes?
You know, yes, and there are a few things to keep in mind. So younger folks are reporting being more targeted for scams, and this is contrary to what a lot of people think. You know, a Cash App Payments Intelligence report found that Gen Z and millennials report being scammed almost twice at the rate of boomers, and this is really because they're online more and more scams are coming through social media.
Yep, and it's here to stay. So what are some of the biggest red flags parents and teens should watch for when shopping online or through social media this year?
So as I mentioned, emotions and money tend to get really tangled up, and scams thrive by focusing on getting people's emotions all riled up. they tend to use urgency, so some red flags that parents can talk to their teens about or be mindful of for their own shopping include things like urgent DMs or messaging, getting messages that say things like only one left or buy now or this deal will disappear, requests to pay outside of secure platforms or with gift cards, any sort of like high pressure message or funky language or typos can be red flags that something is a little bit off. And what I encourage parents to do is to screenshot scams or sketchy things that they see and talk to their teens about how they might look or how they might show up as a way to provide education, not fear tactics.
Talking all things scamming and more, especially when it comes to kids and financial, responsibilities. Talk to me a little bit more how families use tools like spending limits and transaction awareness. I mean, this actually builds trust, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. So Cash App families let parents approve an account for 13 to 17-year-olds. And the way that parents can frame this is, I want to help you learn how to manage your money and feel confident managing these tools, not, I don't trust you, so I'm going to micromanage you. So Cash App lets parents approve contacts, set spending limits, and get notified of new payment requests or purchases. And this helps you build a dialogue with your teen and helps them learn how to strengthen their own financial responsibility.
All right, where do we go for more advice on helping teens? Well, bottom line, spend wisely.
Sure, Shelley. So people can visit cash.app or Cash App in the App Store this holiday season, but of course, year-round.
All right. Keep up your good work. Again, thanks for you, Lindsay Bryan-Podvin. And as a Michigander, the financial anxiety solution should be part of our bookstore. Thank you.
There we go. Thanks, Shelley.
Thanks, Lindsay. It was great. Take care. Well, she writes about it. Troublemaker, the fierce, unruly life of Jessica Mitford. Talking to you, Carla Kaplan, about your latest work, this product of a decade of work, introducing us to a woman who knew how to fight back against fascism and refused to become grim and gray in the process. I look forward to this conversation. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Welcome. I add the Davis Distinguished Professor of American Literature at Northeastern University to your resume, obviously publishing books prior to this. But I look forward to, talking about this troublemaker. Was she?
Oh, she was such a troublemaker. Mm-hmm. And she was called a troublemaker by almost everybody. And she absolutely embraced the term. She loved being a troublemaker. She loved stirring the pot. And she loved defending others from exploitation and abuse. It was the thing that got her out of bed every morning.
All right, let's get into this conversation. Would you introduce us to Jessica Mitford?
I would love to. Jessica Mitford was born in 1917 to a very eccentric and very insular aristocratic family in the Cotswolds. She was one of six beautiful, vibrant, creative sisters, all of whom were denied any education at all, which was quite common in aristocratic families. And they all reached up into the air and pulled down futures for themselves, purely with will and imagination. But only Jessica Mitford wanted to fight for social justice. Only Jessica Mitford, out of all her sisters, had a deep sense of social fairness, and of right and wrong. Her sisters, two of them were famous fascists. One of them married the head of the British Fascist Party, Oswald Mosley, and spent part of World War II in Holloway Prison, was unrepentant all her life, blamed the Holocaust on the Jews. And another one of her sisters actually stalked Hitler, became his intimate, lot of debate over how we should understand that. And when war was declared, she went into a park in Germany and put a pistol to her temple and pulled the trigger and lived eight more years with diminished capacities and a bullet at the back of her brain. But Jessica Mitford always wanted to get away from her very, very privileged, cosseted life in the Cotswolds. She called it a dread place. And she ran away at 19 with her second cousin, Esmond Romilly, to fight in the Spanish Civil War. He was actually killed in World War II, shot down over the North Sea. And she remarried a progressive Jewish lawyer named Robert Truheft, spent 20 years in the Communist Party as an incredibly effective civil rights activist, and then had a breakout success as a writer in her midlife, first with a memoir of the family, and then with the book she's most famous for that revived muckraking called The American Way of Death in 1963.
Oh, yes. Did she leave her mark on celebrities as well, including Benjamin Spock and Dr. Maya Angelou?
Very much so. She was wonderfully influential because she was such an effective organizer and muckraker. But the thing about Jessica Mitford that I think really contributed to how she left her mark on so many people, including Benjamin Spock, she wrote the book about his 1968 trial, Maya Angelou, one of her three lifelong best friends, and then sort of everybody else you can think of, including, believe it or not, Woody Allen, is that Jessica Mitford fought fascism all her life, but she did it also with incredible humor. She had a completely irrepressible sense of humor, and she carried that away from her childhood. All of the sisters were filled with pranks and jokes and made up languages and humor. And she never gave that up. She carried it right into the Communist Party and right into her writing. Everybody wanted to be in the room with her. Jessica Mitford was the activist everybody wanted to hang out with. And I think it really helped her influence on others. So she did write the book on the 1968 conspiracy trial of Dr. Benjamin Spock. One of her three lifelong best friends was Maya Angelou. And anybody you can sort of pick up from the 20th century progressive circles was a friend of hers or claimed to know her or was at her parties. She threw the best parties in the East Bay. She was famous for her parties, not because the food was good, it wasn't, but because she was just the funniest person in the Bay Area.
Thank you for, again, that reminder of who you write of and speak of. Troublemaker, the fierce, unruly life of Jessica Mitford. Again, speaking with Davis Distinguished Professor of American Literature at Northeastern University, Carla Kaplan. All right, and it looks like you have gotten praise, blurbed by, what, three Pulitzer Prize winners?
Yes. Yes, I seem to have friends in good circles. So, and it's really lovely to see an activist like Jessica Mitford, a female activist, getting so much attention because she really breaks apart the stereotype that women activists are grim and gray and no fun to be with. And she provides something for the current moment. So many of us are having trouble getting out of bed in the morning. I mean, the last 3 days of news is just... Mm-hmm. Again, we're all kind of reeling. And Jessica Mitford lived through times as hard as these and worse. And she fought every day of her life, but she did so by keeping up her spirits and the spirits of those around her. And I think that's a very useful kind of lesson for right now when so many of us are struggling to keep our spirits up.
Thank you for that reminder. Did this take you a decade to work on?
I'm afraid it did. It took 10 full years. Jessica Mitford was an autodidact. She was denied education, so she taught herself to be a phenomenal writer. And as an autodidact, and this is true of many of them, she had no disciplinary boundaries. So when she was researching each of her books, she went down every single rabbit hole. If there was a rabbit hole, she went down it. And she left behind virtually 600 crammed banker's boxes of material. So that's a biographer's dream and a biographer's nightmare. Yeah. And I am of the Robert Caro school that you have to turn every page. You have to look at everything. So it took a long time to work through what she left behind.
And describe the front cover.
The front cover are her eyes. So those are her eyes. And she's resting her chin on her hands. And of course, Troublemaker is in bright red because she was a communist for about 20 years of her life. And the cover is very bold. because she was very bold. She was somebody who, in spite of terrible tragedy in her life, and she did live through really horrible tragedies, both political and personal, always got up in the morning ready to make more trouble and fight again. And so we wanted a really bold cover to pick up that spirit of hers.
Hence the title, Troublemaker. Will you present this work to your students?
Oh, yes, I will. I won't teach it necessarily because I hate to force students to buy my books.
Right.
But I have been teaching Jessica Mitford's writing for 10 years and trying to encourage students to take another look at the great work of investigative journalists.
Wonderful. Your work is out. The work is, again, a biography of Jessica Mitford in the work entitled, of course, Troublemaker. How do we find out more information, Dr. Kaplan?
www.carlakaplan.com or www.jessicamitford.com. I share the Jessica Mitford website with the wonderful editor of her letters, a fabulous book also just now out in paperback, simply called DECA. And we share a website, which we call The Life and Letters. So either website will get people right to the book.
Very nice. Thank you. Take care.
Thank you.